So this is work that I did with Ben Lilly and Jing Shu. You can read about it on the archive or on JHEP. I could actually, it occurred to me, have changed my title.
It's like it matters. It's very
okay. Thanks. So here's an outline. I'll start off talking about compositeness in general, and then finish up with the top compositeness. So we need to talk about bounds from the Tevatron, four top signals at the LHC, and some outlook. And the idea here is that I'm looking for interesting phenomena. I'm not actually trying to solve any deep problems, and I'm not going to. So the question is, let's say there is compositeness. Can we actually see this at the LHC, and what does it look like? And in fact, we know the answer to this question. We know that at low energies, model independently, we can write down some kind of effective field theory operators that describe compositeness. What scale factor would you like me to apply to my quantum?
1.5? 1.5.
At least 1.5.
Okay, great. And this is a very powerful approach because it's...
It's model.
Model independent. And and we've been doing this for some time, actually, following the work of Peskin and Lane. And of course, we have projections from the LHC. How well can they probe an operator like this? So this should be understood sort of generically. These are some light quarks, let's say, that will affect some jet observables. Right, contribute to, say, die jets. We have two quarks coming in and two anti-quarks going out, something like that.
Do you assume it's completely flavor symmetric?
Right now, I'm not taking this seriously enough to do that. But sure, for now, let's assume that it's completely flavor symmetric for all the light quarks so that I don't have to worry about flavor bounds and that kind of stuff so much.
Why
is
it coming
in light quarks? Because I chose to write down that operator and not a number of other ones. Mostly because this is just supposed to illustrate the point that I'm eventually going to get to. So this is not supposed to be all of compositeness at the LHC. This is just a manifestation of compositeness at the LHC. So you know, you should write down whatever operators are your favorite ones, involving gauge fields, involving the scalar contractions of the spinners, you know, whatever it is that you like. What I'm going to say isn't going to really change very much because it's going to be generic to begin with. And we know, for example, by looking at the CMS study, then we can actually see an excess for some amount of data, provided this lambda over g is smaller than about 5 keV. Or in other words, if the scale of compositeness is less than something like 5 keV, we're actually able to see these operators.
What's the current bound of this operator?
That's a good question, and I will get there actually in a minute if you'll be patient for a sec. Thanks, Matt. What I want to say first, though, is that this take on compositeness is great because it's model independent, but it's actually so model independent that it's not clear that it has anything to do with compositeness at all. Right? I could imagine that there is some, goodness, our Feynman diagrams are getting big too. We have some weakly coupled Z prime. It couples the quarks. And provided the energies that I'm probing are small compared to the mass of this Z prime, all this does is actually reproduce this operator. Right? At energy is small compared to the mass, I don't see the resonance. I just actually see the residual effect. And then I would identify, say, lambda with the mass of the Z prime and G with its coupling. So the question is, can we see better manifestations of compositeness? Or can we see something that's not so model independent that it could actually be any kind of high scale new physics? So what are two things we might expect in the theory of compositeness? We could expect, and remind me if it gets small again, because it will. We'll see higher resonances, perhaps, you know, maybe some extra bound states that are a higher mass than the lowest modes that we're identifying with the standard model. I have a question.
So if you look at the axis from that sort of operators, doesn't the energy dependence tell you something about whether it's a resonance that you're probing I mean, of course, you're not going to see the resonance because you're way below, but if you start seeing the energy dependence, you can start probing whether it's coming from this sort of operator.
So absolutely, right? Just like neutrino cross-sections. Neutrino cross-sections grow with energy, very low energies, and then eventually that turns off and tails off and turns into a Z resonance, and then after that, just falls with energy. So it's true that if you made a measurement at several different energies, you could actually perhaps even measure the mass of this thing. However, given that we're talking about scales that are large compared to the energies of the LHC, we're not likely to actually have really precise measurements of a lot of different energies. Right? The statistics are going to be small. The error bars are going to be big. So, well, maybe. Right? Maybe. And the other thing that we would really like to see would be perhaps even the constituents. Right? Maybe we'd like to reproduce what we've already done for QCD. We start off with protons and pions. Eventually, we find some higher resonances like rows. And then there's eventually a description in terms of weakly coupled quarks and gluons. Right? At that point, I think you'd really understand that you had a theory of compositeness and you would know a lot about it. Or put another way, the lowest energy states really just probably tell us about the chiral symmetries of that theory. They don't really tell us about the UV physics in detail. OK, so can we see these things at the LHC? And the answer for higher resonances is yes. We have an example like RX with gauge fields in the bulk where we know that we can see these resonances up to a few TeV or so. Constituents, I don't know. And of course, asking these questions becomes very model dependent. Right? As much as the virtue here was that we were very model independent, once we start to talk about anything else, we need to know something more about UV physics, or at least make some assumptions. This was the question that I wanted to address. And I'm not actually going to get here in this talk, but I'm going to show you how far I got, and I think hopefully discover some interesting phenomena along the way. However, the question I think that I wanted to, the first question that occurred to me was, does the standard model already work so well to describe all the data that we see that there's actually no hope of seeing the constituents? Right? It could be that these scales are always of order 5 or 10 TeV. Maybe we see a resonance or two, but we can't actually see anything else. So what I'm going to do is just run through the different sectors of the standard model and put some current bounds on these types of operators such that we can see, are they also bounded that we can't really hope to see the constituents? All right. So let's start with the leptons. A prototypical operator is going to be really just this operator, these quarks replaced by leptons. The best bounds come from LEP2. And in fact, the LEP Electric Working Group has very nicely analyzed a large class of these operators. And you can just look up what the bounds are in their paper. And the answer that they come to is that lambda over g, depending a little bit on what the chiral structure of this operator is, and therefore how well it interferes with standard model processes, is maybe something between 10 and 20 TeV or so. So aside from the fact that the LHC doesn't collide leptons anyway, but I think it's pretty unlikely we're going to see any signs of the leptons breaking at the LHC. The energies just aren't. OK?
It looks like this particular terrain that all your good leptons on the right.
That's right. It's for all of the operators the Electric Working Group decided to analyze.
Not necessarily universal.
Sure. That's right.
So in this particular case,
That's right. So now I'm being serious in the sense that I'm giving you experimental bounds, but I'm being not serious in that I should really look at each operator individually and maybe even let them interfere with each other.
It's 4 leptons or 2 leptons and 2 quarks?
This bound I quoted is for 4 leptons. If it's 2 leptons and 2 quarks, the bound is down by maybe a factor of 2 or something. So it's not amazingly weaker. All right. So the light quarks, so that's the operator that I started out talking about, actually, and that was Matt's question. So the light quarks, we should get the best bounds from the tevatron. In practice, actually, the experimentalists haven't done the analysis in terms of these operators yet. So I can't just look up the answer and tell it to you. What I can do is look at something like a plot of digets versus their invariant mass, look how big the error bars, and therefore how much physics I can put in as a function of that invariant mass, It turns out that if I do this, and again, not amazingly seriously, the bound is something on the order of 5 TeV or so.
So is it in here?
He's not, but he has seen my talk before.
Because he was saying at lunch the other day, and maybe he told it during your talk, but the reason why they don't have bounds on this, I'm putting it together a little bit.
Yeah.
Because in round one, they got too much high PT jet.
That's right.
So they had to up the gluon density function at high X. Now in run two, it seems like it's back down again.
That's right. In run two, you don't see any sign that you need an enhanced PDF. In fact, you need probably less PDF.
That's what they thought it was originally.
That's right.
So they're totally confused, and so they won't do the analysis until they're unconfused.
That's fine.
Is that what you've heard as well?
Yes. Yes.
Well, I don't see how they can ever get unconfused. You know, unless DAISY data provides some constraint, which in the relevant region.
But for the gluons, yeah, it's very hard to imagine that.
It doesn't, you know, so they're never going to get unconfused.
It could also be that their energy resolution, that these are the highest energies that they see, period. So it could be that their energy resolutions aren't quite properly understood between run one and run two.
This seems so critical for LHC. You're going to do something, because you want to go to the high X at that Tevatron so that you can go to the high X and then, of course, much higher Q at LHC. If they can't get unconfused, then how's LHC going to do it?
And high X at the for gluons, the Tevatron is important, right?
Yeah.
But at the LHC, high X of the gluons is the answer.
Yeah.
So the only thing they can do is use the Tevatron data to say that, okay, we're going to run the gluon distribution function and then compare it to the LHC and look for an inconsistency that would be the way to see.
All right, we can also look at the Higgs, writing down Higgs operators. We know we can map this into the famous precision electroweak observables S and T. The constraints here come from LEP1 and slack. And the bounds depend a lot on whether you assume there's some custodial symmetry here that protects you from big corrections to the rho parameter. If it's not, the bounds are very, very strong. And if there is such a symmetry, the bounds are still sort of on the order of a few TeV level. And this is not shocking to anybody who studied bounds on RS. It's very simple. All right, what do we have left then? We have heavy quarks. So the bottom left, and therefore the top left, because they're part of a doublet, these are also constrained by LEP1 and slack through looking at zeta k's into bb bar, or the observable that's called R sub b. Here, the scale is again something like 5 TeV. R sub B really doesn't want you to play very much with the left-handed coupling at the bottom. There are two heavy quarks left, the right-handed bottom. Here I don't have anything to say because the observable that we should be using to bound it is the forward-backward asymmetry of the B, or if you want the asymmetry of the B. These actually show a deviation that we don't understand. And I mean, it's not significant. It's not a clear sign of new physics. But if you were to try to perform this exercise, what you would end up doing is saying that I actually want a scale. I want g over lambda, or lambda over g, rather, to be something. And that something would be of order a few hundred GeV, which is low enough that we don't really understand it.
What operator is associated with RB? Is that what's found on
there? It's one that involves a covariant derivative that has the z in it.
So that lambda is not a four-parameting operator.
No, that's
it's
right.
It's probably z derivative with the v. Okay.
That's right. That's right. If you wanted, you could put NBA counting in here, and that would knock it down because it involves fundamental fields, but I wouldn't do that.
It's not clear that it would be a lambda over g in that case, but that's
okay. Yeah, that is actually true. It's not clear. But also, since all of these operators, what I call lambda and what I call g is sort of up to me at this point, you know, I could just think of this as some new lambda that would describe them.
And Higgs, you already talked about Higgs.
Yeah, that's right. And the same issue came up with the Higgs. It's true. OK, and so what this leaves is the right-handed top quark. And that's actually what I'm going to talk about first. So putting all this together, I would say that maybe it's possible that we could see constituents that are associated with compositeness, say with the light quarks or the Higgs or the bottom quark. But these energies are still high enough that I don't think it's all that likely. It's clear that we could see some resonances associated with compositeness in those objects. It's not very clear that we would actually be able to get to some description where we can talk about constituents. All right. So let's write down an operator involving only right-handed top quarks. And now I'm being more serious with the structure of the operator, right? Because I want only right-handed top quarks and not left-handed top quarks because of the decouplings, this is actually the unique Lorentz structure that I can write down. This is the only operator that involves only right-handed quarks and not right-handed tops and not left-handed ones, or some other gauge fields. I'll say something about that in a second. I should put color indices on my tops. And there are two ways I can contract these things. Well, actually, there's more than two ways, but there are two ways I'm going to contract these things to make a color singlet. The first one is to contract them into a singlet here and a singlet here. So I'll call this the color singlet version of this operator. The second one is to contract this into an octet and that into an octet, and then contract the two octets together. So that's going to look something like that, right? And so both of these operators are things that I should consider if the right-handed top is composite. And maybe they'll both be turned on at the same time, and maybe with slightly different coefficients. Okay. So I got here by thinking about compositeness in general, but really compositeness for top in specific. It's actually interesting to just say, okay, here's an operator. What are the bounds on it? Right? This involves only the top quark, which is the thing that we've discovered the most recently and the thing that we know the least about. So, well, don't call me on that with respect to the Higgs. So it's actually reasonable to say, okay, just what are the bounds on this operator? This is clearly a hard operator for us to probe. We don't have a lot of data with involving top yet. Okay. Oh, and actually, I should tell you that this operator was already considered as a model of compositeness by Howard Georgi and some friends. And they actually considered only the color singlet version of the operator, and they argued that it would be less tightly constrained by precision electron weak data than by TT bar production at the Tevatron. And we currently we agree with those conclusions. But so let's say a little bit about what the bounds are. And I am nervous about the time, so give me some indication when you want to leave.
You see people leaving.
Okay. yeah, that depends. Well, never mind. So there are precision electroweak constraints on this kind of operator. For example, I can imagine that I insert it into a loop of top quarks and correct S and T that way. The bounds are obviously weak. They're weak really because they involve the right-handed top, and you know, the at zeroth approximation, these corrections involve the left-handed top. So they're not actually all that strong. I should say something about flavor, and I'm not going to. In the very least, if I took this seriously as the only operator, there should be some minimal flavor violation induced that involves charm and up. However, I don't think the constraints are strong, because again, it's right-handed quarks. We don't have a lot of data. It also involves d mesons, which we don't have a lot of data about those either. And it involves mixing angles that are not really very related to anything in the CKM, right? Because it's the right-handed sector that's mixing here. So I'm just going to ignore flavor. And that's ugly, but.
I'm a little bit confused. How could you see manifestations of the diagram? Because you always have high order corrections which never been calculated.
That's true. Well, so, I mean, right, so what I have in mind here is something like that.
Yeah, well, that's
so we have higher order corrections that have been calculated.
Yeah.
And we have even higher order corrections that haven't been calculated. So clearly, once the operator's effect gets small enough to be in the mess of what we haven't calculated, I can't say anything anymore.
Why is this diagram not the one where one Z attaches to each bubble? Is that also important?
Actually, yes. I mean, that's right. I could have done this one.
Yeah.
Sure.
Sorry, does this, I'm sorry, I came late, so maybe this is a dumb question, but does this operator, does it preserve electroweak?
Yes, so these tops are right-handed.
Okay, so this is...
So there's no SU2 structure at all.
It doesn't contribute to precision electroweak at all. I mean, it...
Well, okay, but the top has a mass.
Okay,
right? but that's part of the reason why it's so small.
It's much smaller, therefore. It doesn't matter how big that is, as long as it's perturbative, it's much smaller than the top contribution.
Yes.
Okay.
However, the top contribution is huge, so that's not a safe place to start.
Okay. Yeah. I understand.
But you're right. I mean, that is part of the reason why this is really not the right way to start this operator. Okay. So we should actually then look at direct measurements of the top quark. And right now, there's only one place we can do that, which is the tevatron. The first thing you could imagine doing is let's produce a top anti-top pair. I'll insert my operator and turn this into four top quarks total. But at the tevatron, this actually doesn't work very well because four tops is small. I mean, it's got a large mass and the PDFs just run out. The tevatron doesn't have enough energy to make four tops any appreciable amount of time. However, if you did see it, that would be really remarkable, right? Because the standard model production of four tops is completely unobservable. Actually, as it turns out, it's probably unobservable even at the LHC in the standard model. But I'll get to that in a second. All right. So let's look at TT bar production. So what are some of the operators that would come along with this in a theory of compositeness? Well, these are operators that modify the top coupling to the gluons. Right? So these modifications can then lead to a modification in TT bar because I just insert this new vertex right here, making TT bar. And there are two operators at dimension 6 that do that. And you can find these in this big review by Buchmuller and Beiler that enumerates all possible dimension 6 operators. So these little t's are right-handed tops. So we have an operator that involves the gluon field strength. It's contracted with this TT bar. It's actually T bar and the covariant derivative acting on T. This is contracted into an octet, so I can make a color singlet. And you can see the Lorentz structure. That's one of them. And what I'm doing here is saying, OK, the coefficients here are not, they come from the theory of compositeness. So it's not exactly the same coefficient that I would expect here. In fact, you could use naive dimensional analysis and estimate that they'll actually be somewhat smaller. But I set the overall scale to be the same, since the overall scale of compositeness controls the size of those operators. And then the second operator I can write down. Generator in there. This operator is a chromomagnetic moment for the top quark. All right. So if we look at the effective theory that's below the scale, so let me back up one second. So what do these operators mean? Well, they mean that you have some high energy gluon that's actually probing the internal structure of the top, and this operator is the first deviation you would see as you do a power series in those form factors that control whatever the colored constituents inside the top are. All right, so these operators are actually related to this one. In fact, this particular operator will be induced by loops of the four-top operator through a diagram like this one. And so actually, even if you just say turned on this operator at the scale lambda and then evolved down to some scale that's appropriate for TT bar production, you're going to actually induce this operator, and it's going to have some log in its coefficient that's related to the fact that it was induced by that one. And this operator is less related. So in other words, this coupling is going to have some piece that grows like the log of the compositeness scale. And I put the mass of the top quart here because that's the scale where TT bars are produced. Right? There's also some other term that came about by what the value of this operator was at the compositeness scale lambda itself. However, if this lambda is a lot bigger than the top quark mass, I can hopefully expect that this log would dominate, and then I'll just consider this piece. Right? That's an assumption that I'm making for now. And we can go back at the end of the day and see if that assumption actually works. All right, so in practice, what I'm going to compute is TT bar production induced by the four top operator itself, and I'm just going to keep the log piece because I'm not doing the finite pieces correctly. So I take this graph, it interferes with the standard model production of TT bar. I'm going to ignore the fact that there is a small fraction of about 10% of TT bars of the Tevatron that are produced by gluon fusion. Right, it's a small fraction, so I'm not making a huge error by ignoring it. And again, assuming that the scale lambda is big compared to the mass of the top, I can expect that the leading effect is going to be when this diagram interferes with that diagram. And that's going to be bigger than this diagram squared by itself. So I can write down the cross-section of Q2 bar going to TT bar. And given the assumptions that I've made, this actually factors into the standard model cross-section. But that's an artifact of the fact that I'm only keeping the log. The non-log pieces don't factorize in this way. And now there's another factor. The one is just the standard model piece. And then there's some dimensionless coefficient. There's a loop factor. And here's the log, where S is the invariant mass of the TT bar system. Invariant mass of the event if I ignore radiation. All right, this dimensionless coefficient, again, having assumed that this contribution was induced entirely by the four top operator itself, can be computed, and it actually it'll be different depending on whether or not I have the singlet or the octet version of that operator. These details probably don't matter all that much, but it's 2/3 for the singlet, and it is minus 4/9 for the octet. So at this point, what I should do is I should look at TT bars at the Tevatron. I should compare with the invariant mass distribution, right, the distribution in S, and then I can put a bound on this operator. Right? Clearly, at large S, I get a bigger lever arm because this raw energy scaling is bigger. And there's also less TT bars from the standard model to compare with. So if I were to do that, what would it look like? So we have the differential cross-section in S. This cross-section turns on twice the top mass, or 350 GeV. It rises very quickly, and then it falls off as I go to larger and larger invariant masses. So you can think of this as the standard model. If I turn on the singlet, then what will happen is at low S's, it won't disagree very much. But then as I get to larger S's, I'll start to see that the cross-section falls off less fast than I expected to. And I actually exaggerated how much this is growing relative to the standard model when I drew it. So you can say this is a singlet.
It's a constant, I guess.
It only doesn't because of the PDFs. Right? If I was doing an E plus E minus machine, it would go to a constant because what would happen is it would just be dominated entirely by 1 over lambda squared. But my theory is breaking down there anyway.
But they can stitch around.
But the core CDFs are falling, so.
It's constant in the core PDFs.
Just understand, what is the scale of deviation? I mean, is it on the GeV, tens of GeV level?
I'll get there in 1 second.
Yeah.
And of course, with the octet, I'm going to see a deficit. And in fact, actually, CDF, and I think even maybe a day or two ago, G0, have done studies exactly of this distribution. they're not really interested in sort of a general enhancement or deficit at high energies. What they're actually looking for is some narrow resonance that's appearing here. Something maybe like a lower mass than we expect, but an RS includes a Klein gluon, so this distribution would have actually a peak at some point when I get to the mass of the gluon. I can't actually make the comparison, and the reason is that the data that I have available includes their experimental efficiencies, which I have no hope of reproducing exactly at the level that they did them, and it also includes some backgrounds from non-top processes. They're complicated, they come from QCD. So
I must have a prediction that they compare to their data.
That's right, but they didn't tell it to me. So the information is there. It's just it's not presented in a way that a theorist can actually digest. I'm actually talking to even some of your colleagues at Davis, and they're going to do this. So. All right.
So I thought there was also, there was a T prime search that might be easier to compare to because it's very obvious, it's pretty well defined what the model is there.
So, it's true, but the problem isn't the model of the new physics. The problem is how they're modeling the actual standard model TT bar. Because what they're giving me has all the effects of their detector on it. Okay. Right? And I can make accurate predictions that sort of work at the, whatever it is, factor of two level, but I can't reproduce exactly what their detector is.
So qualitatively, I know that in the T prime analysis, sort of at the two sigma level, there is an excess of events of large invariant mass.
That's right.
Well motivated.
Could you give us an estimate on the error bars on your standard model?
Well, on this distribution, no, but on the inclusive cross section, yes.
Okay.
So I should say two things before I move on. The first one is that this analysis actually normalizes the standard model to the data. So it doesn't contain any information about the overall, this particular analysis. It doesn't contain any information about the cross section itself. And if you're the kind of person that is titillated by 1.5 sigma excesses, they see a point that jumps up, that's just for interest. The data kind of peters out at around 800 GeV, and they have one point way out here at 900 GeV or so. So I was impressed that the Tevatron actually sees TT bar up to very close to a TeV. Okay. So I can't actually compare with this curve, even though I will eventually. The next observable I can think about that I can compare with is just the inclusive rate of TT bar production. Right, I can take my prediction, I can actually convolve it with the PDFs, integrate over the center of mass energy, which is the same thing, and this turns this differential cross-section into the complete rate for TT bar, and that they present to me, in a simple way that doesn't have much to argue with. So.
A very lame question. Your predictions, whether they vary when you change the top quark mass or they're within the...
My predictions have enough residual haze in them that varying the top quark mass doesn't worry me very much. Obviously, the standard model predictions do vary with changes of top.
The definition for the top mass, top or what?
Yeah, if you ask them, they'll say something glib, like it's the definition in NVIDIA.
Yeah.
That's actually, I would say, the number one question in top physics is now that the errors are small enough, what is it that we're actually measuring? But that's a different talk. Okay. So I'm going to compare with the CDF measurement. And this is actually a combination of several different channels at CDF. At the moment, it's actually the most accurate, meaning it has slightly smaller error bars, but only slightly. More importantly for me, it's actually a better agreement with the standard model theory, so I get a tighter bound if I do that, and I think I'm being conservative as a result. D0 has a measurement. The error bars are pretty much very close to being the same, but it actually deviates a bit more from the standard model, and that would give me more wiggle room that I don't think it deserves. So I've got the CDF measurement. It's got statistical, systematic, and luminosity uncertainties in it. I'm just going to add them all up in quadrature naively because I don't know what else to do. And I should compare this with the standard model prediction, which is 6.6 plus or minus 0.8. So when I combine all these errors properly, these don't really disagree with each other. The error bars are big. That gives me some leeway because if the error bars are big, it takes a long time for them to notice what I'm doing. It's interesting, perhaps, that the CDF and also the D0 values are high compared to the standard model. And that will give me more wiggle room because as I start to add new contributions, the data actually likes that for a little while. And that's why I didn't use the B0 numbers, and that's just because they're even a little bit higher than this, so I get more room there.
But how low a scale of lambda would it take to start affecting the total cross-section at the level of these errors?
That's right. So that's obviously the next thing to do. So, and this actually asked the question that I was, answered the question that I was asked a few times, and I put off till here. It's actually shockingly low, right? I mean, this is clearly low enough that all the assumptions I made that lambda is big compared to the top mass are out, right? This is not the real bound. However, it's what I have. Clearly, there is a bound that's going to be a little bit better than this. And right now, I'm actually working with some students at Northwestern, and we're computing this cross-section seriously. And then we'll have a bound that includes all of these quote-unquote subleading effects anyway. So what I'll assume from now is that I can get away with lambdas that are sort of on the order of 500 GeV for Gs that are on the order of 1 or so. So since this bound isn't trustworthy, I'm not going to take it seriously. All I'm going to do is say, OK, I have at least shown that there are very weak bounds on the compositeness for the right-handed top port, given the Tevatron data.
Sorry, what's
this 500 GeV? So I don't trust this bound. So let me invent a bound that I do trust a little bit more. And this is what I invented. Yasunori is deeply disturbed by this. I would say that probably you can get away with somewhat smaller lambdas, actually, for Gs that are this small, too.
And maybe the question is what you're doing with it. It's obviously not an experimental bound, so what do you mean by bound? What role is this going to play in your subsequent discussion?
In order for me to convince myself that I'm not actually already ruled out by this bound, which is not trustworthy, but at least was done seriously, I will restrict myself to this sort of regime.
That's what I meant.
Sorry.
The weakness of bound is essentially coming from, you think about the Mandel process, right? Except the Mandel process.
Not really, because I mean,
the total cross-section is dominated by the threshold, and this thing is turning on at large.
Exactly, that's the real.
This is a wrong way to bound this thing. I mean, you really want to look at distributions at large invariant mass, but that's tougher to do. You need to do a more, you know, experimentally, you have to do a more serious.
So you're saying that the PDF of the light quarks is not trustworthy?
It's not the PDFs. The PDFs of light quarks are very accurate for almost this entire regime. The real reason why I don't do the comparison is just because I don't have access to the data.
Tim, did you consider the graph where you go to balloon into the loop, the TT?
So I didn't because it's only 10% of the total rate. But of course, when we do things seriously, that will be in there.
How do you know the points? Well, just because the top is heavier.
Well, because I know the Tevatron, but just from the standard model, blue is about 10%.
The factorizational work the same way, right?
Okay.
The LHC might be quite a different story.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't do this at the LHC this way.
You're thinking that if you do this, you fit to the S, you will get the cost much.
I get a better value. Right.
I
didn't actually explain it right. I used the wrong words. Okay. So nobody's left yet. I'll take that as a good sign.
11:12, in case you're wondering.
Okay. All right. So to go past this discussion in terms of operators, what I have to do then is make some assumptions about the UV theory. So if you remember, I said, okay, at the beginning we see these operators. These are the small deviations. Then at the next energy regime, perhaps I see some higher resonances, and then finally the constituents. So let's think about some of the resonances that I might see. Obviously, since it's the top quark that's a bound state of something, the something has to carry color and electric charge, so the top quark itself will. So we can expect that some of these resonances are going to be colored and perhaps electrically charged.
So those effect times will be formed because top decay is very quickly.
Right, remember, this is a new confining force with some really, really big lambda. So I would say that, yes, for any lambda that I really have in mind, you're not really, well, first of all, you can't talk about tops, because tops are the bound states themselves, right? So what you're saying is that is there time for these constituents to actually organize themselves into bound states that I would see in some way, or is it just a big mush? And the answer is it depends on the theory. All right. Of course, there's lots of questions I should ask at this point. What are the quantum numbers of these residences? How many of them are there? I know that somehow they should give me, or they should respect this bound, right? The effects of the residences should not affect PT bar beyond that. Okay, so what I'm going to do is assume that the bound I derived is more or less saturated by these resonances and by a single one. So I'm going to imagine some row. So in analogy with QCD, I'll call it a row. I could imagine, say, a color octet or a color singlet. And now those four top operators I wrote down are just exchanges of these guys.
So the problem is confusing. Of course, after convolving integral over S, of course, you get bound. But even if you're looking at this, in order to trust this method, S should be smaller than lambda squared, right?
Yes.
And one root factor is always there, so unless the data is better than one root factor, like the 50%, you don't get.
Well, yeah, it's a one root factor, but I mean, it's a little facetious because I wrote it in terms of this parameter G. The one with a couple theory is probably fairly big, so maybe the loop factor isn't. I mean, right, if I was doing NDA, I would just set it equal to 4 pi, and the loop factor would disappear.
Then you have to sum all those bubbles up down the line.
Yeah. Which is why I kept it as G and didn't do that. That's right.
It seems like all threats from, I mean, if this is really A to G, if I take it seriously, then it should affect all threats running.
Sure. I mean, don't take it seriously is what I'm saying.
And what I'm saying is that if you sort of dismissed all of the trivial precision data, I mean, it's not trivial, it's strong precision data. But if you do that, you can probably get a better bound.
That's right. So what I have on, what my faith is when actually I can compare with this distribution, the bound I get is going to be sufficiently high that, well, maybe I can or can't trust the fact that I took a large lambda limit, but certainly the bound is going to be high enough that the main constraint is going to come from PT bar itself.
But S should be smaller than lambda squared, which is good, right?
Yes, that's right.
So it's always mathematically one loop.
Yes.
It's there always, right?
That's correct.
So unless the data is better than, say, a few percent, you don't get bound in the region where this calculation is really trustable, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would agree with that. I mean, the standard model piece itself is falling very rapidly with S, and...
But this is a fractional correction, right? This is a fractional correction, not...
It is here, but once I actually add, right, this is because I only kept the large lambda limit.
Yeah, if the log is very large, then you may be able to increase some and so on.
Couldn't you get a more realistic bound on lambda just from the ordinary quark compositeness? Because, I mean, that's an analysis that's been done. And for the very large, invariant mass jets, then there's a good fraction of them are actually top. We just don't know, presumably, right? So, I mean...
I don't think that's true, actually. I think at the Tevatron, the high invariant mass jets, a very tiny fraction of them is top. But also, actually, it turns out there is no experimental constraint on even four light quark operators right now, and we actually had some discussion about this at the beginning.
So error is like a 10%-ish, right?
Yes.
I mean, even at that very high S. I mean,
that's
even
right.
Bigger. So that's the order. I mean,
no, that's right.
It is your trust, your calculation, and probably this is a few percent, right?
But you could also imagine the angular distributions are going to change if I go to the subleading terms, right? And those I can measure perhaps more precisely. I mean, my only statement really is that I believe I can do better than this, because this is absurd.
All these statements are in the general class of if you have power law suppressions on operators, as you go up in energy, you go from nothing happens to suddenly spectacular things happen. And so the framework, the scale at which sort of a little bit happens and it's sort of perturbative and so on is actually fairly narrow.
That's right.
Actually. So that's the general lens.
I'm saying at the scale or at the place, at the S, at the value of S, where this expansion in terms of G over lambda becomes not trustable, or not really trustable. Still, this effect is one loop down. That's all I'm saying.
That's
because it's particular. So, it's nothing to do so.
All right. So, I'm going to start talking about color octet rows and color single rows at this point. in the last 5 minutes that I have. Am I just doing Randall syndrome? I would say that the answer is no. I'm trying to think more generally about theories of compositeness that don't necessarily have the special properties of Randall syndrome. The most important one is just the fact that RS has got a job to do. RS is solving the hierarchy problem. This tells me what the structure is well enough that I get very tight precision electrode constraints and flavor constraints, as we heard a couple weeks ago. Right? So for example, in RS, the Higgs is composite because that's how RS works. By making the Higgs fundamental, I'm not solving any problems anymore, but I'm also avoiding the precision electrode weak bounds. And that's why it's not absurd to talk about some kind of color octet with a mass of 500 GeV or so. Right? In RS, that would just be ruled out. Okay. So, in order to specify the properties of these objects, I've got to tell you something about how they couple. I can expect generically that there is large coupling to top, and generically there is some kind of small coupling to the light quarks. And again, I would say this is a case where RS is maybe not the most generic thing to imagine. In RS, this coupling is, you know, a factor of a few. This coupling is like 1 over 5 or something. And that tells me that RS is in a regime where at the LHC, looking at QQ bar, producing one of these color octets and then decaying into top quarks, that's actually a reasonable signal with a reasonable rate. If I just went to more of something like an NDA estimate, this coupling would be small enough that my claim is RS would not be interesting. That is, it wouldn't be interesting in the regime of the masses that we talk about, right? These sort of 3 or 2 TeV resonances, we wouldn't produce enough of them if we just went to the NDA estimate. But I'm not saying that's what we should do. I'm just saying that I am legitimate in talking about couplings of the light quarks that are smaller than is typical in RS, and therefore maybe different production mechanisms. OK. So let's do the color octet and the color singlet separately. For color octets, if the coupling to light quarks is neglected, so, then the dominant production mechanism can very easily be pair production of the octets. Again, because these masses may be actually somewhat on the low side. So if the masses are down around 500 GeV, I can have two ordinary gluons, and they produce two of these, you know, call them KK gluons if you want, right? These resonances, these rows. So glue goes to row. And the nice thing about this cross-section is that, obviously, it depends on what the mass of the row is, but the couplings involved are just QCD. So once I know what the mass is, I can actually tell you what this coupling is with what the cross-section is with no model independence, with no model dependence at all. In the case of a color singlet, I can't do this. Obviously, I can't collide gluons to give me a color singlet, but what I can do is produce a pair of top quarks, and then the top quarks can radiate one of these rows, which will then eventually decay itself into TT bar. And in fact, I mean, here, because of the large couplings, I should expect these guys to decay into TT bar.
Why can't you collide gluons to color singlet and rows?
Because that would be a one-loop process. I mean, yes, you can write down the operator, but you would expect that it's going to be suppressed by the fact that these fundamental gluons are combining to give you the color octet option. And this cross-section obviously is proportional to the square of the coupling of the octet to the to the top quark, because if I turn that coupling off, this radiation just never happens. OK, so we have pair production in QCD, and then we have radiation off of the top quark. And obviously, for the color octet, this process happens too. It just turns out that it doesn't dominate for most of the masses that I'm talking about. So finally, I found some new phenomena, right? Here is a form of new physics that tells me to look at four top quarks being produced at the LHC. This is something that I hadn't heard anyone talk about in and of itself before. since then, I've heard a lot of people talk about it. OK, so let's make a rough sketch as a function of the mass of this object. So this goes from 500 to 5,000 GeV, or 0.5 to 5 keV. Imagine the scale is linear, for whatever that means. And then I'm going to stick some log scale on the cross section. And this is the cross section for producing four tops, and it's measured in femtobarns.
This is going to be Tevatron or LHC?
And this is LHC. Yeah, I think I've gotten as much as I can out of the Tevatron at this point. I'm not going to get four tops there.
Right. Okay.
So the first thing you might be interested to know is that the standard model four top rate is about four femtobarns. So it's somewhere around here. And obviously, it doesn't care about any parameters in this model, right? It's just what it is. And I can overlay on this some of, so this is not going to be too pretty, and I apologize for that. But I can get the color octet rates. They're, so what I've done here is, so these are the color octet rates. They're not very sensitive to what the value of the coupling is. So I varied the coupling here between 2 pi at the highest curve, 1, and 0.1. And that's just because they're being produced mostly by pair production anyway, right? The production cross-section doesn't care what this coupling is. All this coupling does is guarantee that once I produce it, it really decays into four top quarks. And then for the singlet, I have a much stronger dependence on the coupling. And these are the same values of the couplings for the singlet production. And you can see that as I dial the coupling down, obviously the cross section goes down. OK.
There's another way to produce singlets. through you glue with a top quark loop, and then the singlets come out, right?
Yeah.
And that that's can be significantly higher than the standard model, because there's sort of a parallel theory on this, which is top quark condensate.
Yes.
And then the condensate forms the scalar, which is like the crystal top condensate stuff. And then you can pair produce those, which is a PQR.
Those sides of four top
level events.
That's right.
Which can be sort of equivalent to this.
It might be. I mean, I think the fact that you have a genuine loop suppression there, that's why we didn't consider it, but I agree. I mean, the fact then that you get the fact that you don't have to pay the price of producing two extra top quarks may compensate for the loop suppression. So, all right. It actually is going to turn out, though, that the observable rate is somewhere up around here, at least with our analysis. So I'll say a little bit about that, and then I'll finish up since we're running out of time. So this cross section has to be bigger than about 30 femtobarns or so on the analysis I'm about to present to you. If so, I'll be able to discover it with 100 inverse femtobarns at the OH. But this is a good question, right? Can we actually observe four tops? Can we reconstruct them? Can we tell that there were four tops there? It's not actually obvious that we can. These events are really messy. Four tops give you a lot of decay products. The jets get confused with each other. They merge with each other. They overlap, even though in phase space the tops weren't close to each other. But one of them can throw its products back into the jets from the other tops. So it's not so easy. There was a study done by Aaron Pearson collaborators that used a jet mass. So they tried to make a big cone that would suck all the top decay products into it, and then ask, what is the mass of that jet? We didn't want to go that way because, well, as Joey Houston told us 2 weeks ago, jet masses are dangerous. Even QCD jets actually have jet masses that extend way out into the TED region. And honestly, I just don't think that I can estimate what the rate of that is until I see LHC data and I can understand things like underlying event and that kind of stuff. So the strategy that we took was instead to look for two like-sign leptons. So the idea is I have four top quarks being produced. These decay into WB. All right, where this is actually B bar and that's B bar. So we're looking for the case where one of these W's, and in this case it's a top decaying, so it's a W plus, gives me one lepton, and then the other top has a W that also goes leptonically, and it gives me another W plus. And then I'm not going to ask actually what happens in detail with these other objects. So the real important thing, I mean, the thing that really defines the analysis is that you have two leptons. Each one of them has a PT bigger than 30 GeV and sits in the central part of the detector. And this is actually a good enough cut that it'll pass an Atlas trigger. So we can actually keep these amounts. I'm not sure, I mean, I would imagine that CMS can also do this too, since these are reasonably stiff cuts on leptons. And I keep all combinations of electrons and muons, right? So this could be E plus, E plus, it could be mu plus, mu plus, it could be E plus, mu plus.
So you're looking at the most energetic two leptons?
Actually, I just asked that there be two leptons that had the like sign and that pass these cuts. I didn't want to play games with which lepton was which, because I mean, there are leptons that sometimes come from the T-bar decays. And so, you know, you don't want to throw those away when they're part of the signal.
Okay. You've got plenty of leptons from B-core production. For B-core,
that's right.
I mean, you have to have isolation criteria, which...
It's absolutely right. So let me go through the backgrounds really quickly. So there are actually some legitimate physics backgrounds. The standard model does produce two like sign W some of the time, but it's a very, very small fraction. Right, this is an electric process. You can imagine WVB bar. So this is the background you're worrying about.
You've got four Bs also.
Sure.
Which is QCD.
That's right. Well, the way we deal with it is that we ask all of our leptons, or lepton in any jet, be somewhat isolated.
Isolation.
Right, and that actually does do a very good job on this background. This background is bigger, I would say, than the 4B one, because hiding inside here is single top production, which is a 2-to-2 process. So there's more phase space here. You can imagine that I produce a W in jets, where one of these jets takes a lepton. You can see I was having fun with being able to run PGS at this point. And then finally, there's W plus, W minus plus jets, where I misidentify the charge of one of the leptons from the W decay. And this actually, before applying any cuts, this background is huge because included inside it, until at least because I haven't asked about the flavor content of the jets, is TT bar production. So we put all of these things in the NAT event. We ran them through Pythia to shower. We hadronized them also using Pythia. Then we ran them through PGS using the default LHC detector. And we looked at what we got. I should tell you, there's one last cut, actually, that we applied that's pretty important. So we summed over the PT of all jets, the missing PT, the PT of the leptons. Right, this is like the HD variable or the M effective variable. And it correlates well with the total center of mass energy of the event. And we cut this to be bigger than 1 TeV. The reason for that is that if we have four top quarks, we have to have enough energy to produce four top quarks. So we chose the 1 TeV just because it seemed to do a good job of separating the signal from the background. Alrighty. So in light of the time, let me just characterize. The biggest background was from the TT bar, or the W plus W minus in jets, with the charge misidentified. And this background was sort of around 3.0 after flying all these cuts. And in fact, actually, it was really what drove the value of 1 TeV here. This cut was mostly responsible for cutting down the dominant background.
Sorry, you just said it, but I just missed it. What is accounts? Where is the same sign lepton coming from? It's a fake? Or?
It's a fake. So it's a real lepton, but the charge is misidentified.
Oh, the charge is.
So one of the interesting things is I found out how often PGS thinks that happens for our leptons, and that that misID rate is on the order of 1 in 100. Obviously, we don't want to use PGS to estimate this, and I don't know how realistic PGS is, but I think it's interesting to see that this is something that we really do need to understand.
Because these are very high, some very high PT?
Well, they're not very high PT all the time. I mean, these tops are not amazingly boosted. right? We have these two 500 GeV-ish objects, perhaps, right? And yeah, the tops are a little boosted, but. But yeah, that is a good point.
I think you're more likely to get the sign on because the track is straight.
Of course, yeah. So this is a highly PT-dependent statement. I haven't really examined it in detail. All I can tell you is that my leptons have this rate.
So that's confident misidentification, or we didn't know what it is and we think it might
be? No, this is confident misidentification. So we're sure it's a lepton, but we happen to get the charge wrong.
We're sure of the charge, and we just have to.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't give me a measure of the sureness of the charge, so.
Well, the straightness issue, I mean, that's the key.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
If it's straight, you say, I'm not sure. But it seemed to register that it's negative. And then you just throw all those nouns out.
Right, but PGS is not that sophisticated when you get into it.
Right, but it's not a real background, if that's the case.
That's true.
If it's an unconfident charge for misidentification, it's not an issue.
That's right. Also, you could imagine that if I just tightened my quality cuts, maybe I could make this go away. So, all good points. The rest of the backgrounds are all...
To see whether PGS does produce a momentum-dependent misidentification.
I'm pretty sure it does, because it's actually looking at the hadrons that are being produced by CFIA. So the track information is there.
What I would wonder about is just whether the isolation, whether that PGS thing takes into account isolation. Because, you know, if a jet is inside a lot of activity,
yeah,
it might be. I know, but I'm saying PGS. So I'm saying PGS uses one number. Doesn't it take into account the fact that you've looking only at events that are isolated. This just looks surprisingly high to me.
Well, PGS is pretty sophisticated.
I guess, right.
If it doesn't have that in it.
Is that right?
Yeah.
My guess is that in as much as I can trust it at all with things that are nearby.
It's a pretty good signal.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It's pretty good by definition. Okay. The rest of the backgrounds are all roughly the same size as this. And those are much harder to imagine cutting down because of the fake rates. How am I doing?
You're 5 minutes after.
5 minutes after, okay. In the next minus 5 minutes, I will tell you that the signal for this octet with a mass of 1 TeV and G of order a few, I think it was actually 2. But we saw that it doesn't really matter what G is for the color octet anyway. Then the signal rate is something like 115 femtobarns. So I actually have cross-section to spare at this point. The efficiency is about 3%, and it's almost, so that's the efficiency between the four-top final state and what I actually reconstruct. Almost all of that efficiency is just asking that I get two like sign leptons. It's just the branching ratios. And then there's a very little bit of inefficiency in the codes. Okay.
That's to be compared to this three
septobar.
So does that also have all the decay branching ratios in it, or
will it be used there? Yeah, so this has no branching ratios in it, but this does.
Oh, that does.
So actually the...
down this 115.
So the signal observable is more like 40 femtobarns. Or in other words, if my four-top rate is 40 femtobarns, and after going through all my efficiencies, I'll actually still be able to pick this out at 5 sigma with 150 femtobarns. That was a line that I kind of cartooned on here. What's kind of interesting is that for moderately strong couplings in the octet case, I can actually go out to about 2.5 TeV or so, which means that this process is sort of on the borderline of working for RS itself. So I mean, I don't know if you would want to do that, but it would be interesting, and maybe it would help Shree disentangle his electroweak bias from RS from color octet ones. Okay. However, I have an analysis. I can see my signal. I haven't actually told you that there are four tops because I haven't reconstructed them. We tried to reconstruct tops and Ws. We failed miserably because of combinatorics, so I'm not going to do that. There are some clues you could get. So for example, four top quarks produce equal numbers of L plus L pluses and L minus L minuses. Electroweak production mechanisms, like this one in the standard model, for example, will favor W plus because of the fact that there are more ups and downs in the proton. So that would at least sort of argue that you see something consistent with four tops. I haven't applied any B tags. Applying B tags, clearly I expect to see B tagged objects here. It turns out that for the signal, the mean number of B tags was somewhere between 2 and 3. for all these backgrounds, including the PP bar, the mean number was 1. There's lots of jet activity, right? There's all these other tops decaying, and I haven't asked anything about those yet. Those could be a handle. And finally, I also expect that there's missing energy coming because of the neutrinos that I predict. And I can even predict the missing energy spectrum, which would let you distinguish this from, say, sources of L plus that were not associated but with W production. So I can't really imagine what those would be. OK, so then in the last minus 1 minute, let's just say a little bit about outlook. So actually, let me first conclude. My conclusion is that the bounds on a right-handed top quark are not very strong. And it's possible that we could actually see a lot of interesting manifestations of this at the LHC. And there's still more work to be done at the Tevatron, too, I would say. So with a compositeness scale that's really so low, really of order several hundred GeV, you could actually imagine that maybe I can see constituents that make up the top quark. Right? I would say this is the only part of the standard model where I think there's at least a reasonable chance that the bounds are weak enough to let this happen. So you can imagine that I can go into some regime where these constituents are described by some weakly coupled quantum field theory. It's like a QCD and a few GeV. I start being able to talk about quarks and gluons. Some of them are colored. I can pair produce them at the LHC. So you know, imagine that I have, say, gluons. And now they produce some of these constituents. I don't know what to call them. Now, having produced them at high enough energy, you could imagine that some of the phenomena of QCD could also apply here. So for example, you could imagine that maybe they have some amount of energy that they can shower with. Like this new strong force can produce some other constituents. Right? So maybe they... And then eventually, they have to hadronize. And they hadronize into top quarks. So what you can imagine is at the very, very highest energies the LHC probes at the end of its lifetime, maybe actually what you get is a pair of these constituents being produced. And then these things shower and hadronize into what looks like a jet of top quarks going in a similar direction. That's a pretty bizarre signal. I have absolutely no idea if you could reconstruct it, but I think it would be pretty fun to try. So thank you. That's right. So just like I induced an anomalous chromomagnetic moment, I also induced an anomalous magnetic moment of the top quark. My guess is that since we don't have good measurements of the top couplings to photons, and we're not likely to have them short of an ILC, I don't know if there are strong bounds, but it's certainly an interesting phenomenon. That's right. Right, but I don't want the electron or muon to be composite. So I really am going to sort of steer away from that as being more model dependent.
Actually, about the photon coupling to the TT bar, you've got a program for photon-photon collisions and TT bar production at the LHC. So this is quite normal.
And I would say that it would be very interesting just to push in that direction. And there are some studies that seem to say you can do it maybe with a lot of statistics. So.
Literature, but I would think that some of these resonance cases would be around twice on top or something. And then, in the compositeness interpretation, and then you would have really unusual three-body decays and competing two-body decays, which would go to photons, actually those frequent, like, the scalar component.
That's right.
So you'd have resonances that would go to two photons on one side and maybe a three-body decay on the other side, a TT star or something on the other side.
Yeah, that would be a lot of fun, actually. I guess with the spectrum of resonances, you know, I think that anything that you can imagine is possible. It might be that the top quark is light for some reason, like the pion is light, and so that this naive scaling of masses doesn't hold, right? Maybe the top right is needed to maintain anomalies or something. So it gets spit out as a light fermion of this theory. And you can engineer that to happen, but it's
you
not.
You engineer that with only the right top and no other?
No. That's why I didn't show it to you. You could also use supersymmetry to control the effective theory enough that you could guarantee that the right-handed top was light for a, you know, because it's you know, because you understand the low energy limit of the theory well enough. And you know, there are examples of theories that do that, like these fat Higgs theories and stuff were in some of their incarnations.
Okay,